You and I back together again to wrap up a very busy week, Friday, October 8th, 2021, on Connecticut Today. On the show, we chatted with former CPTV programming head Larry Rifkin. He's got a new book out, No Dead Air, Career Reflections from the TV Executive Who Saved Barney the Dinosaur from Extinction. University of New Haven economics expert David Sacco joined us again, this time to talk about a new poll contrasting the economies of the U.S. and China. Is China really gaining on us or not? Local guy that a lot of people know, and the name is synonymous with Connecticut media, national media, talk radio in this state. Name of the book is No Dead Air, Career Reflections from the TV Executive Who Saved Barney the Dinosaur from Extinction. I used to have this guy on my show several radio moons ago, and he's back, and he's an author now. Larry Rifkin is the guest. Hey, Larry, how are you? It's been too long.
Good, Paul. It's great to talk with you. My dog was very upset, though, hearing about the delay in the Westport Dog Festival. She's out here on the deck with me right now.
Well,
and I'll tell you, she'd be far and away the winner. She's so gorgeous.
Well, you know, on the 17th, Larry, take her down there. Maybe she could find her Fairfield County trophy mate down there. You never know, you know.
Absolutely.
Paul,
it's nice to hear you on the air. You've been a staple yourself in Connecticut media for so long. And it's amazing how our paths all cross about 18 different times.
Yeah. You know, Larry, I remember you were sitting in my studio, some radio moons ago at another station. And it's a true story. I don't know whether you remember this. We were talking about the stuff that you were developing at the time, like, the Yukon women and all this other stuff. Barney had been well established. My son was watching it every waking moment. And I remember you sitting back in the chair and saying, God, I love what I've done in television, but what you do is so cool. And I said, well, Larry, someday become a talk show host. And that was kind of a nice way to cap things off, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. I left CPTV in 2009, though I consulted for a couple more years after that. And I went back to my hometown, and I talk about this in my book. And it was one of those difficult moves, in a sense, because I had been kind of playing in a big ball yard, if you will. But I came back to Waterbury. And I was really thrilled to do it. And I was really thrilled to be able to make some changes in governance in Waterbury, going to district election of aldermen. And I had a kind of a different approach to talk radio, like yourself. I think, really somebody who might be on one side or the other politically, but was always open to listening to other ideas. So at first, Paul, I didn't think I was really cut out to be a talk show host because I wasn't one of those inflammatory guys. But then I realized that it opened it up to a lot of people who didn't really like the screaming, the yelling, the shouting, but they liked a little more reason, a lot of energy, a lot of knowledge. And so I was able to bring, I think, a lot more women into our audience, really.
Larry, hang on. We'll be right back. I'll do a little business here. The guest is Larry Rifkin. The name of the book, No Dead Air, Career Reflections from the TV Executive Who Saved Barney the Dinosaur from Extinction. First, though, traffic and weather together at 3:36 on WICC. And no doubt thousands and thousands of folks in Stratford, Bridgeport, New Haven, all throughout Fairfield and New Haven counties probably heard the name over the last several decades of Larry Rifkin. Name of the book is No Dead Air, Career Reflections from the TV Executive Who Saved Barney the Dinosaur from Extinction. Larry, I suspect we're about the same age, and I grew up watching public television in Connecticut, but public television was always, as you well know, kind of a niche market. A lot of classical concerts, a lot of how-to shows, the heady political discussions, pre-cable news. But it really did change, didn't it? And I know you, and undoubtedly this is in your book, you had a couple of things in there, a little bit of a role in there at kind of changing, Larry, what public television did and how it was perceived by people.
Well, thank you, Paul. I mean, Connecticut Magazine typified the years that I was there, and it was as the head of programming for about 25 years. and they typified it as the Elvis years. I mean, I came to public television having come out of, you know, commercial broadcasting, if you will, radio when I was very young. I grew up a radio brat. My father was a radio station manager. And then I went into politics a little bit. I was the assistant to the state commissioner of education, doing his communications and speech writing. But I came to public television always wanting to build an audience. And don't forget, I came and then Jerry Franklin came, and Jerry Franklin saw me as the public relations person there and said, hey, look, you seem to know more about Connecticut than anybody else I talk to here on staff. I really want you to take over the programming shop. And so I wasn't imagining that I would fall. I didn't think I was ready, but he saw something in me, basically saying, look, this car is stuck in the garage, and if you can make it start and take it anywhere you want. And so I had free reign. And what we did, Paul, we tried to mirror a lot of what national, you know, PBS was doing in terms of environmental programs, historical programs. We did the entire Connecticut Experience series with the Humanities Council. Then we did all the incredible nostalgic documentaries that they still air, the Hartford Circus Fire, the USS Nautilus, you know, shows about Mark Twain, the Wadsworth Athenaeum, whatever was major in the state of Connecticut, we were going to be there to cover it. And then, of course, with UConn women's basketball, I say something in the book that may be, well, something that someone would want to challenge, but I would find it hard for them to do that. Number one, it was the most successful local franchise in the history of any PBS station, because 18 years ratings that were unsurpassed, you know, no other program in public television came close to what we were getting night in and night out with UConn women's basketball. The fundraising capacity was incredible, and it changed our whole relationship. Now, I was building that change for many years before that, but nothing tripped the wire like UConn women's basketball. It was, well, you know, Paul, lived in this state.
What was it, Larry? Were you able to do that, you know, with Gino coming here and taking a program that was just an afterthought that used to play, you know, in the field house when the roof leaked? And when I was at BU, I walked in one day, oh, we're doing the game from there, but it's leaking there. Okay, you can move down 5 feet. Larry, were you helped because the Whalers left and you were able to hone in on something that people could rally around in this state? Did that help when, unfortunately, we were looking for something to say, this is us?
Oh, absolutely. This is us. No, that series wasn't on for many years.
You know
anyway,
what I mean.
No, I'm kidding. Well, let me say this. I don't think there was anything that could have tied the state together. Not only for sports fans, forget even the Whalers fans, because I'm sure there were some who came over to us, but we had non-sports fans who grew to love UConn women's basketball. And many of the people, well, you see the obituaries in Connecticut, a woman who dies and they say she loved crocheting, gardening, and watching UConn women's basketball.
Yeah.
It became so pronounced in this state, men, women, sports fans, others. What else could Connecticut Public Television or any television station have done to bring the type of allegiance and the type of, you know, consistency, particularly in the winter months, Paul, when, as you know, television viewing is the highest.
Yeah.
And one of the things that did that, and I say this in the book, is that they were really, you know, television is a character-driven medium. And they are characters. Gino Auriemma hasn't left.
Oh, come on.
He's been there all these years.
In a state, for four years. Yeah, and in a state, Larry, replete, and I can say this because my name ends in a vowel, in a state replete with stubborn Italians, who better to focus on than Gino Auriemma, right?
Exactly. But look at the women that he brought through. And every 4 years, they would stay for 4 years, where the men's program would have to create a new star every year or two because they went on to the NBA. So it was just such a beautiful franchise for us. The state's university, along with the state's public television network, it was remarkable, absolutely remarkable.
Larry, were you ever confronted, and you don't have to name names, obviously, I know you wouldn't, but were there moments in the meetings at CPTV and with UConn, did people look at you and say, Rifkin, you're nuts? Women's college? No, they come to us to watch painting and pottery shows. Are you out of your mind? Come on, tell the truth. That did happen, didn't it?
Well, first of all, when we attempted it, it was experimental. Yeah. In 1994, during the Big East tournament, we were told production was in place. Would you be interested? And we took a lark. I mean, it was a lark. And in the book, I say one of the things that really attracted me to the notion of this, believe it or not, Paul, and you know how instinctive this media is, that, you know, you have an idea, you think it'll work, and then you try it out. And sometimes it doesn't. I talk about a lot of failures in the book because, you know, there are a lot more misses than hits. I was lucky. I was a rainmaker with a few really big hits, mm-hmm. but, you know, they're not there every day. And I said, when I thought about L-O-B-O, Rebecca Lobo,
yeah.
everyone had heard the name. They saw her for a minute on the 11 o'clock news, but they hadn't seen a complete game. So we tried it. And I'd like to say I was on. You know, that's the great thing about public television, Paul. I could get on as the programmer and find out whether I made a good decision or not. And I said the phone started ringing in 1994, mm-hmm. and they didn't stop until we lost the contract to SNY many, many years down the road. And so, you know, it was just remarkable. So where did the pushback come? It yeah. wasn't internally, and we really didn't have a contract with UConn until 1996 when they put it out for an RFP. And I think it's a really interesting story in the book because Jerry thought that Lou Perkins, you remember Big
yeah,
Lou.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, he was a character, you know, larger than life. And he thought that he wanted us to share it with a commercial station, that he didn't think public television alone could pick it up and do what he wanted with it. So I went out and I started negotiating with all the commercial guys in town. I went back to Jerry Franklin. I said, Jerry, here's my recommendation for what it's worth. I think either we get it all together alone or we let it go.
Good move.
Because I think even if Channel 3 had it only for five games and we had 15, the public's perception, given their promotional heft, would be that we had just a small number of games. They had the preponderance of games. And Jerry, to his credit, said, okay, if that's what you think. And then we owned it for the next 16 years.
Mm. All right, Larry, hang on. Going to be back with you. I want to talk about, yes, the purple dinosaur when we come back. Larry has a fascinating story about why a lot of parents, like myself and grandparents, saw their kids growing up with Barney. First, though, traffic and weather together, Wall Street and more right here on WICC. A couple of more minutes, an extended segment here with Larry Rifkin, name of the book, No Dead Air, Career Reflections. From the TV executive who saved Barney the dinosaur from extinction, and Larry, let's talk about Barney. And, yeah, I mean, for millions and millions of parents and grandparents, Barney was a friend to their kids, their stepkids, their grandkids. Tell the story, and you've told it before, and I remember you telling me, how did this all come about?
Well, it was Super Bowl Sunday, 1991, in my little town of Prospect, Connecticut, right outside of Waterbury in New Haven. I went into the video store with my four-year-old daughter, Leora, and it was just another, you know, manic Sunday. And we went in, and she was not a big videophile, Paul. She really wasn't. But all of a sudden, you know, she pulled this tape off the shelf. At that time, it was VHS, and it was Barney and the Backyard Gang. And a Day at the Beach. So it looked innocuous enough. We took it home. I was well aware that PBS was looking for some more children's programming to supplement Fred Rogers and Sesame Street. They needed more because really children's programming is one of the hallmarks of public television. We went home And she wanted to watch it, Paul, over and over and over again. And I said, there's something here. And I looked at it. I saw a character, a main character, who wasn't quite as neurotic as Big Bird. I saw kids really leading a lot of the activity, even though at that time Sandy Duncan was part of the production, so there was an adult presence, and Barney wasn't really that surrogate at that time alone. And then I saw just different color schemes and different things that they were trying to do that seemed pretty interesting, though I will say the production was very nascent at that time. We had a lot of work to do to get it to PBS standards, but I then took it to PBS once I had called Cheryl Leach down in Texas, who created the character along with Kathy Parker and Dennis DeShazer, her partners, and away we went. And believe me, it's a lot longer story, and I tell it better in the book, so you got to get the book.
Oh, absolutely.
But anyway, so we were $2.25 million away from having this remarkable, sensational experience that, again, for me, Paul, look, I only wanted to have the best editorial shop I could have in the state of Connecticut. I was blessed to be able to do that. We had won lots of Emmys leading up to this here in the region, but I overshot. I didn't realize that I was going to have to manage one of the most incredible phenomena in the history of children's television, and that it would be as controversial, in a sense, as it became.
Absolutely. And finally, Larry, in about the 2 minutes we have left, what did you folks learn, or what did you learn in your tenure about fundraising? And not so much you asking for people to send in money, because, you know, listen, that's the way most public television. I know there's underwriting and there's crude sponsorships now. But what can you tell us about the kind of person that you learn that donates to CPTV or public television in general?
Well, you know, it's a very wide range. I mean, people think that they understand the demographic of public television, but they really don't necessarily. I mean, when I met an indigent guy in Hartford one day who said to me, you know, I love public television because I'd never be able to travel to the places that you take me. I would never be able to meet all the natural world that is out there, but certainly is not available on the hot streets of Hartford. I mean, that touched me. And so that reminded me, even when we expanded our audience with UConn women's basketball, to think that the public would not ultimately embrace an issue of equity with women's sports, and then to embrace CPTV for taking on this experiment, even if it time shifted some of their favorite programs, cultural programs like Great Performances, then I thought people were thinking too minimally about the availability of an audience to us. So our audience really responds, I think, when you're genuine, when you're authentic, and we appealed to them on the basis of so many different programs. I mean, think about this old house audience versus the Metropolitan Opera. I mean, they're very different audiences, but you have to reach them with a genuine message. And I think we were able to do that for many years.
Folks, get the book. You'll love it. No Dead Air, Career Reflections from the TV Executive Who Saved Barney the Dinosaur from Extinction. There's a lot more in it, though, about the inner workings of television and, of course, the great history of CPTV. Larry Rifkin. Larry, it's been a pleasure. We need to get together for a couple of adult milkshakes one of these days. And we'll have them in purple just for Barney. Larry, we'll be in touch. Thank you.
All right. You take care, Paul.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Larry Rifkin there. Again, No Dead Air, Career Reflections from the TV Executive Who Saved Barney the Dinosaur from Extinction. Yeah, that's the way I remember the story when Larry told me that 20-something years ago. Sandy Duncan was in a crude kind, as Larry said, the production values weren't great on this tape, but man, I remember my son. Oh, man. All heck used to rain down on me when I stopped the videotape and my son was watching Barney. Wow. There's a new poll out there that says, amazingly enough, Americans sense China is eclipsing the U.S. economically, and they say protecting U.S. jobs should be a priority. Okay, is that in the easier said than done category. We had this gentleman on earlier in the week to talk about the Pandora Papers, and he's back to give us his thoughts on a lot of this posturing, U.S. versus China, from the finance department at the business school at the University of New Haven. David Sacco, MBA. He's a practitioner in residence in the finance program there. He's also involved in several organizations. He serves as a full-time instructor in the finance, economics, and management and entrepreneurship programs. He holds a BS and an MBA in finance from NYU, among other credentials. And David, good to have you back on again twice in a week. How are you, sir?
Good, Paul. How are you?
Not too bad. Did you read this survey, David? I mean, why do Americans have this perception? Is it rooted in any truth here, or is this just kind of some muddied up waters?
I think it's a little bit muddied up in the sense that, you know, the Chinese economy has grown quite substantially in the last 20 years. The U.S. still has the world's biggest economy by quite a bit. Obviously, a lot of industry and a lot of different businesses have moved and now come from China. But the U.S. and China have much more of a symbiotic economic relationship than I think people give credit for. Yes, we buy a lot of goods that come from China, and that means that a lot of manufacturing jobs that used to exist in the U.S. and other countries now reside in China. But at the same token, China buys a lot of U.S. government securities. So all the dollars that China gets from all the goods that we buy, they basically turn around and lend those dollars to our government, and our government uses them to fund a lot of programs. So it is a much more symbiotic relationship, and it's not as much a confrontational relationship. Is it one that we both provide a service and value that the other needs, right? We U.S. consumers benefit quite a bit from the fact that China is able to manufacture goods a lot more cheaply than we are in the U.S. And then Chinese businesses and the Chinese government then essentially are investing in the U.S. economy. So I think it's a win for everybody.
You know, David, I remember reading a story a few years ago, and we see these stories from time to time, and I believe it was in the Wall Street Journal or Barron's or something like that. And it was interesting. They said, well, okay, all you folks are upset that all these iPhones and Samsung Galaxy phones are made overseas. Why can't we make those in the U.S.? And the point of the story was, and they did an analysis here, and they said, well, okay, you want to bring that production back here, that's great. Your average off-the-shelf iPhone is then going to cost 2 to 3 times more. Is America willing to pay that? And again, David, we live in a price-based economic system to a lot of people, so it really is not that simple.
That's exactly right, Paul. In the world of a global economy and global trade, what we really want is we want Chinese companies to produce the goods that they can produce most cheaply and most efficiently. And we want U.S. companies to produce the goods that they can produce most efficiently. And remember, a lot of innovation comes from the U.S. A lot of manufacturing comes not only from China, but other parts of the world where labor costs are lower. And, you know, yes, at one level, the argument is, well, that means that, you know, Chinese workers are getting paid less to do the same jobs that Americans did. But at the same time, the standard of living in China and other places is rising because those people are being lifted up from even lower levels of income than they were before. We're getting more products more cheaply. And then we get to focus on the industries and the things that we do well, like I said, which leads to a lot of innovation. Now, there's a lag in that, and some people do sort of get left behind temporarily as they have to acquire new skills so that they can participate in sort of that higher level economy and that innovation and technology that we have. But ultimately, society as a whole wins because we are creating more economic value in total for everyone. What that means is that the benefit to U.S. consumers is more, it offsets the loss for U.S. workers, basically.
David, hang on. Great stuff. We'll be right back with you. First, traffic and weather together, and then more with David Sacco from the University of New Haven coming up right here on WICC. Americans sense that China is eclipsing the U.S. economically and say protecting U.S. jobs should be a priority. That's what they sense. Not really the case, say a lot of economic experts. And David Sacco was with us, finance department practitioner in residence at the University of New Haven. David, in the Trump years, there was this constant thumb-in-the-eye approach from both parties, the White House and Beijing, over tariffs. In particular, what's the situation with that now? Is that still a point of contention that strengthens the economies of the U.S. or hurts them? Where do we stand on that right now, David?
So I'm not sure it necessarily strengthens the economy. I know it's something that plays well for politicians. In fact, I was reading last week that the Biden administration is actually keeping in place a lot of the different tariffs that the Trump administration put in place. Again, that plays well with a certain political constituency, which, you know, is okay. Politicians do have to answer to the people that elect them. But in terms of real economic value being created and what it's doing, you know, ultimately goods are going to be produced where they can be produced most efficiently. So we can put in tariffs, which are basically artificial price controls. That's not going to stop China from producing those goods. It may not necessarily even cause prices to go up for U.S. consumers, because most of those goods, there's a lot of options for replacement for, but it makes for a good political soundbite. In reality, I don't think it has a huge impact on the overall economy, because China's going to keep producing those goods. We're still probably not going to produce those goods here in the U.S., and we'll just wind up buying them from someplace else.
One thing that has always fascinated me, David, when you look at how the U.S. deals with China, and not just us, but the Western world and Europe and some of the other countries in the Asia-Pacific region, you have this incredible economic giant here, and they undertake some stuff that's just magnificent with their transportation and their infrastructure, yet they're a communist dictatorship. And how difficult does that make it to deal with, David, for guys and gals with your background in the investment and banking world? I mean, would it be any easier? Would they be even a mightier power if they were a democracy or a freely elected country? Or does this still give them control that they like?
It definitely gives them the control, and it allows them to do things that creates, let's call it, consternation in the financial market. So recently there was a Chinese real estate company that has run into some financial problems, and they've got dollar-denominated debts and debt holders all over the world. And what the Chinese government basically came in and told them is, we want you to pay off your local debtors and not necessarily pay off the dollar investors overseas, right? So they don't quite operate under the same set of rules. Now, the flip side is, because the Chinese economy has grown so much and there's still so much growth potential, remember, it's a market of a billion plus people, a lot of whom are now moving from poverty to middle class, and they're going to become consumers. A lot of companies globally want to participate in that market. And basically what we've decided is they're willing to take that risk and be able to participate in that growth, but understand that they're not dealing with the same kind of rules that we do in normal economies. And I think that's where the political debate comes in, which is, if every country around the world is operating in the same economic system with the same sense of fairness and the same rules, and China's operating differently, that's unfair at some level. But I think businesses around the world have decided they're willing to accept that unfairness for the opportunity to participate in a market that can grow as much as China can.
David Sacco, MBA, practitioner in residence, the finance department of the College of Business at the University of New Haven. David, once again, thank you. Have a great weekend. We'll talk down the road. Appreciate it.
You too, Paul. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. There you go. Well, no. So despite what people think in that survey, David Sacco says, no, the American economy is just fine, and in many ways still far superior to anybody else in the world. All right, folks, we'll do it with open phones now for the rest of the way, for the rest of this hour, and for the 5 o'clock hour. Don't forget Yankee baseball tonight. Just having some fun. Relax. Oh, man.